Thank you. Thank you for inviting me to come out here. I'll just give you very brief description of my involvement in this area. My background is actually in mathematics. I was in graduate school in applied mathematics at MIT, but I'd gotten interested in biology as an undergraduate, and so sort of had my eyes open for something I could get involved with that was related to biology, and I discovered this area of sequence comparison, which was a pretty small area at the time, and ended up getting involved in that and did my dissertation on that and just continued in the area. I now work at a place called the NCBI, or the National Center for Biotechnology Information. We didn't invent the name, Congress did, I think. And, this was set up at the NIH in 1988. It wasn't quite clear exactly what its purview would be, but in the first few years, NCBI was given the responsibility of building and maintaining GenBank, which is this database of DNA sequences. And so a large component of the group is involved in maintaining this database and actually building a number of new databases. This has been a very active area as the data has poured in over the past decade. And there's a smaller part of the NCBI that is more theoretically focused, which is the part that I'm in. But we have a lot of interaction with the people who are actually building the databases and the analysis programs. So, the groups I usually talk to are made up of biologists, and so I'm used to a somewhat different focus, and I will try to pitch my talk slightly differently, but I'm very happy to have people interrupt and ask questions and tell me I should talk about something else than what I am talking about. The reason that people compare sequences, and you may have heard a bit about this last week, is that most of what goes on inside cells involves protein molecules. And so one hears a lot about DNA, but the main function of DNA is to tell the cell how to make proteins, and most of the business of the cell is conducted by protein molecules. Proteins are these long strings of amino acids, of which there are 20, and they fold up into a whole variety of different shapes. For a long time, when people were trying to determine the sequence of proteins, which just means the sequence of the amino acids that make them up, it was a somewhat laborious process. And this got somewhat revolutionized in the late 1970s when people found out a way to sequence DNA. So it's a lot easier to deal with because DNA has a uniform structure. You have all sorts of sequence, but it's just this double helix. So you can much more easily automate the process of determining the structure of DNA than determining the structure of proteins, which tended to involve a lot more chemistry. And so most of the protein structures, protein sequences that people have come from translating DNA sequences. People worked out the genetic code, which basically tells you how to read a DNA sequence and tell what the protein sequence it codes for. That got worked out in the first half of the 1960s. And so if you have a protein, a DNA sequence, you can translate it to the protein that it makes. Now, since it's very easy now to get DNA sequence information and therefore protein sequence information, we have a lot of this. What people are quite interested in are the three-dimensional structures of proteins, and those are much harder to get. And there's been a great movement in recent years to automate this process, and I know there are a number of groups, some number here in California and elsewhere, that are working on automating the process of getting three-dimensional structures for proteins. There's a database of these three-dimensional structures, which is called PDB, and a lot of people are very interested in comparing structures, looking at them, and figuring out how to design drugs that might interact with certain proteins, and also predicting what a three-dimensional structure is from the one-dimensional information of simply the amino acid sequence. However, you can learn a lot about a protein just by comparing the one-dimensional sequences without any reference to the three-dimensional structure. And since we have a lot of sequences and relatively few structures, frequently the main way you can learn about sequences is simply from this comparison of the one-dimensional sequences without knowing anything about the three-dimensional structures. And that is really what I'm going to be talking about today. What sorts of things do you learn from comparing sequences, and how do you go about it? Now, in sequence comparison, I tend to think of there always being essentially three questions. And the three questions are, first of all, to define what it is you are trying to optimize. People have a sense of two sequences being similar. That may be a sort of an intuitive sense, but you need to crystallize that into a definition. And actually, in many aspects of the problem, coming up with a good definition is a large part of the problem. Once you have a definition of what you're trying to find or optimize, then there you essentially are faced with a computer science problem of how do you do this efficiently and quickly, so that becomes essentially a problem of algorithms. And then you are faced with a statistical question, that is, you can always throw in random sequences into whatever algorithm you have, and it'll come up with some similarity between these random sequences, but it will have no biological meaning. And so you need to know how strong a similarity is before it's of interest and before you want to devote a lot of resources in terms of experiments to this. In fact, tomorrow, and I'll show you a story of something where people really made a big mistake in terms of attaching significance to something and really got steered down a wrong path because of it. So the statistics are also important. Now, there is a tension between these things, because you can come up with very simple definitions of the similarity between two sequences. For example, you could say, what is the longest run of identical amino acids between one sequence and another? This is a very simple definition, and there are very fast algorithms for dealing with this, and the statistics are relatively simple compared to some of the other things, but it throws out most of the interesting biology. And so it's not that useful a definition to study. On the other hand, you can come up with definitions that include everything you might know of a biological nature about the sequences, and it becomes completely intractable to deal with these ideas, definitions from an algorithmic point of view and from a statistical point of view. So you want to somehow come up with a definition that captures enough of the interesting biology that you can make discoveries with it, but that is still tractable from a computer science and an algorithmic point of view. And of course, the proof is in the eating, and that is whether you can make interesting biological discoveries using whatever method you've come up with. Now, just to give you a flavor of the sorts of thing one does with sequence comparison, I want to give you a brief story. This is about 10 years old. I think this happened in 1990, as I remember. There was a race to find the gene for a particular disease called neurofibromatosis. Neurofibromatosis is a disease that was sometimes referred to as the elephant man's disease. There was this famous Englishman who'd sort of grossly deformed. It's now thought he actually didn't have neurofibromatosis. It's thought he had a different disease called Proteus syndrome, I think. But in any case, neurofibromatosis is sometimes called the elephant man's disease. It involves uncontrolled growth of nerve endings, and in the mildest form, it just gives little splotches on the skin, but it can lead to large growths and in some cases become very deforming, and some of these can turn cancerous. And there was, this had been mapped to a location on a specific chromosome, on chromosome 17. And there was a couple of people involved in finding this. Francis Collins, who is now the head of the Genome Center at the NIH. At the time, though, he was at Michigan, and he had been working in collaboration with Ray White in Utah. So not a mistake that you have a lot of geneticists in Utah. The reason is that there are a lot of Mormons in Utah, and Mormons are essentially God's gift to geneticists. They do several things that are very useful from a geneticist's point of view. They have historically had many children. They've historically kept very detailed genealogical records and kept very detailed medical records. And so these three things together, and also a somewhat isolated community that tend to stay in this community. So these three things together make it very useful to use this community to help map certain genes. And so Ray White, who is working in Utah, and Francis Collins, who were working together, they, as frequently happens in science, had a falling out as they got close to the prize, went their own way, and had a race, and which ended in a dead heat when they published on the same day in Science and Cell that they had found the location of this particular gene. And this was big news. And this was the paper in Science, July of 1990, where they give the DNA and protein sequence of this gene. So you have the DNA sequence, which is the four letters, and the protein sequence, where there's a one-letter code for the 20 amino acids that make up the protein. Now, this was quite interesting, but having found the gene, you want to know what it does. Now, about a year before this, people had found the gene for cystic there's the shorthand where people say the gene for something. Obviously, the function of genes is not to give you disease. This is a shorthand. When you say the gene for a certain disease, what you're really saying is it's a gene for some useful property of cells, some useful thing that when it goes wrong gives you the disease. And so people say, someone has the gene for this disease. What they're really saying is that they don't have frequently the right gene for that. They everyone has the same gene, and they have a defective copy of that gene. So that's sort of a shorthand for this. But in any case, the gene for cystic fibrosis had been found a year before, in fact, by Francis Collins. And by comparing it to other proteins, you could immediately see that this was a protein that formed a little pore in the cell membrane through which small ions could pass. And it was a chloride ion channel. And this tied in with a lot of what was known about cystic fibrosis. And so it opened up further avenues for research. When you find a gene like this, you sort of want or hoping that it will be related in general to something that people have already studied, and that can give you a good idea of how to pursue the research further. When they compared this protein to the database, both groups, Collins and White, there was nothing there to be found. There was just this long sequence, and they really had no clue as to what the function of this particular protein was. Now that summer, we had a high school student who was working in our group, was getting on the nerves of a guy in the next office. His name's Mark Bogusky, and is now gone off to work for industry up in Seattle. But Mark wanted him to do something. And so at the time, GenBank was not under our control. And in fact, one big complaint about GenBank was that a paper would be published like this, and people would want to go and analyze the protein, and frequently it wouldn't yet be in GenBank. You'd have to wait half a year or a year before it finally got entered into GenBank. And so people research was held up. So Mark said, look, go and type this sequence in, and we know that they searched. You looked. They read the paper, they'd searched the database, they couldn't find anything. So go and type this thing in and we'll do the search. So the high school student went and typed the whole sequence in, which, as you can see, that only takes an hour or two, but did a search. Now, and use this program, BLAST, which you'll be hearing a little bit more about, but this is a program we had just developed at the time. It's actually, there were other programs that did essentially the same thing as BLAST at the time. There's a program called FASTA, which is a program that's still in use and is still a good program that also searches databases for protein similarities. And he ran this query sequence, which is, you can see it says entered from cell, and got this similarity. The number to look at is actually this, which says that the probability of this particular similarity occurring by chance in this database search was 0.0038. It was very unlikely that you would get a similarity as good as this. Now, I'll be talking about what do I mean by a similarity as good as this. There's some numbers here. Where do those numbers come from? How do we attach numbers to the similarity of two proteins? And how do we put a probability on it? That's sort of what I'll be getting at. But this was very unlikely. That's not impossible, but certainly unlikely that this could have occurred by chance. It was this IRA1 protein in yeast. Well, he had no idea what this IRA1 protein in yeast was, but went to another database and pulled up the paper where this was described. And just reading the abstract of the paper, it says that it's involved in the regulation of RAS. Now, this, if you're a molecular biologist, immediately starts bells ringing, because RAS is a protein that is involved in a very large percentage of human cancers. Now, here's a protein here's a disease that it's involved in uncontrolled. It's not cancer, but it's sort of like a pre-cancer where you have uncontrolled growth of certain cells, and its protein is similar to a protein in yeast that is regulating RAS, which is controlling cell growth. And so this made some sense. So one could immediately then go to the go and get a review of this. Here's a little mini review, and see what this IRA one was doing, and within about half an hour have a whole theory about what NF1 might be involved with. And so this is the sort of thing one can hope to learn from sequence comparison. In any case, Mark immediately called up Francis Collins, who he had met a year or two before when he was giving a talk at Michigan, and in fact faxed him this and explained what he'd found and so forth. And Collins called him back, said this is very interesting, and they should definitely pursue this. And then he called him back about 2 hours later, and he said, I just got a call from the New York Times, and they tell me that Ray White is publishing a paper on this tomorrow, and we have to rush our paper out. Well, so Mark was up all night trying to put together a paper on this. It was a little too short notice. So you'll notice this fax was August the 8th. Here's the front page of the New York Times on the 10th of August about this. And if you read this, you'll say, Dr. Collins said he had made similar observations about the link. These similar observations were having gotten a phone call from Mark Bogusky an hour before the New York Times called him up to ask his comment about this. But in any case, so they missed the scoop on this, but of course it wasn't the end of the story. This, of course, then led to experiments where you could take the yeast cell, you could knock out the IRA1 gene, which doesn't kill the yeast, but it makes it very sick. It doesn't grow the way it should. You can insert the human version of this into the yeast, and it restores the function. And so this theory about the connection can be established experimentally. Yes, that's a good question. The reason the original papers hadn't seen this is I don't think that biologists were quite as savvy about sequence comparison at the time, and they both people had compared their sequences to GenBank, but both were using a version of GenBank which was about 6 months to a year old, and because the sequences grow exponentially, it meant that about half of the available data wasn't in the versions. And so eventually someone in the group, well, in this case Mark, got around and did the search. This sort of thing happened a lot back 10 years ago. It doesn't happen so much now because, first of all, the databases are all updated daily online on the net, and people are much more savvy about this. And it's a lot easier not to make this sort of mistake. But that was why neither group had found this when it was that sequence was in the database when the papers came out and was waiting there to be found. It took them several months to notice it. So that's just the story about what one does with sequence comparison. But now let's get down to the nuts and bolts of what goes on. When people started comparing sequences, this was really back around 1970. There were very few sequences to compare. But when people started comparing them, they were generally interested in doing global sequences comparisons. You had one sequence and another, and you wanted to align them from one end to the other. Now, in general, the sequences were not of equal length. One sequence would be a little longer than another, and when you lined them up, you could see that you needed to insert or delete characters in one or the other sequences to get them line up in the best way possible. And there was a sort of a bit of discussion at all these points of what's the best way to define what we're trying to do in aligning sequences. How do we want to define this question? And the methodology that most people gravitated to eventually, although there have been variations on this, of it, is that you could think of an alignment in this sort of mathematical framework. You write one sequence here, you write another sequence here, and you think of taking a path through this graph from this node to this node, taking only horizontal, vertical, or diagonal steps. If you take a diagonal step like this, it means that you're aligning this residue with this residue. If you take a vertical step here, it means that this residue doesn't appear in this sequence. And you can either, in general, you're looking at two sequences that are extant sequences from two current species. What's presumably happened is there was a common ancestor that diverged over time, and you don't see what the common ancestor was, you just see what the two current species are. And so when you see a residue in one that isn't in the other, it presumably was either there or not in the ancestor, and so it either got inserted along one route or deleted along the other, the path leading to the other species, and you're not quite sure which. You can figure that out by looking at more than just two sequences. If you look at a lot, you can get a sense of where the deletions took place and where the insertions took place. But if you're just comparing two sequences, all you see are people frequently refer to these as indels. It's a short for insertion or deletion, so people talk about indels. Okay. So you had this path, and you could say, what is the best, and we want to put a score on these alignments. So any path through this graph would correspond to an alignment of the two sequences. And people were asking, well, what is the best alignment that you could have of these sequences? So you needed to put a number on it. And the simplest thing that you could come up with is you could say, well, you get, a plus one for a match and a minus one for a mismatch and some other score if you have an insertion or deletion. And you want to get the best score. So you want to maximize that score. Well, algorithmically, there's a simple way of doing that, and that is that you can think of each node in this path graph as representing an alignment of the beginning of one sequence and the beginning of the other. So this node represents the best alignment of this part of the sequence to the best beginning part of this sequence. And the only way to get into this node is from one of these three directions. And so if you knew the best score for each of these three, and you have a score for traversing each of these edges, and the score for traversing the edge would be either a match or a mismatch as you come down this edge, or an insertion or deletion as you go down the other edge, you can find out what the best score is from coming from any of the three directions by just figuring out what that is and what the score from each direction is and take the one that optimizes it. And you can also remember which direction you came from that gave you the optimal score. And so you can sort of fill this path graph in, starting with a zero here and just working through this until you get the score down here that gives you the best score for the global alignment. And by keeping track of the direction you came in, you can do a trace back. And generally, there may be more than one optimal alignment. There may be several different ones that give you the same score. But you can do a trace back and find one or all of the optimal alignments. this program, this dynamic programming algorithm, was put forward in 1970, actually in a slightly different version than I described, although this is the version that came to be generally used, and it's generally attributed to a pair of authors called Needleman and Wunsch. So when people, if you read the literature on this and people talk about Needleman Wunsch, they're generally talking about these global alignment algorithms. Now, there was a lot of discussion after one had this definition and this algorithm for optimizing the alignment of what were the best scores to use. And there are a number of issues that the most obvious things were matches and mismatches. And that might be okay if you're aligning DNA sequences, but when you're aligning protein sequences, it was obvious that certain amino acids are very similar to one another, and certain ones are really very dissimilar. And it was useful to try to capture that information somehow, to capture the information that not all changes were equally good or equally bad. One idea was to look at the genetic code. So if you went and looked at the genetic code and saw what were the DNA sequences that coded for a protein, you could say, what is the minimum number of changes in the DNA you need to make a change between two particular amino acids? And so people based scoring systems for proteins on the genetic code. Another thing that people discovered, this wasn't until the early 80s that this really got proposed, was that the way one scored gaps originally, each insertion or deletion counted, had the same score associated with it. So if you had a deletion of 5 residues in a row, that was the same as 5 individual deletions of an amino acid. However, if you look at the biology, a single mutational event can insert or delete a large stretch at once. And so, to a biologist, an alignment that has one long insertion or one long deletion is a lot better than alignment with a lot of tiny short ones. And that wasn't at all captured by the original scoring system. And so, the alignments that tended to get produced would have lots of these little gaps that didn't seem to make much biological sense. So people proposed different definitions for gap costs. The one that actually is used most frequently is just a very simple one. That is, it's like a taxi. You charge a lot when you get in, and then you charge a little bit as the ride goes on. So it's basically, you get hit for a big charge if you have a gap at all, and then there's a small additional linear charge for the length of the gap. And these are referred to as affine gap costs, and they are widely used. There's a very minor modification of this algorithm that allows you to use affine gap costs in the same asymptotic time. The time for this algorithm is obviously the product of the lengths of the two sequences. And if you use affine gap costs, it's still the same time. There's a constant factor added to that, where you have to do a little more work for each node. Basically, you have to know whether coming into that node opened a gap or whether it just continued a gap. So you sort of have to calculate two numbers for each coming down and coming horizontally. But that's basically all that's involved in that. So these were the sorts of issues that people looked at in the early days. And the statistics of these global alignments, no one knew nothing about. And basically, people hardly know anything about the statistics of the global alignment still. There are some results that are available. But basically, if you take two random sequences and you start making them longer and longer, There are just beginning to be some rigorous results about what the mean optimal score is, what the expected score is. But even in the most even in the case I've described here with just zeros and ones, there isn't really a mathematical proof of what this comes to. If you make a few simplifying assumptions, as Ralph can tell you about some of these, if you assume, for instance, that rather than having two random sequences here, each diagonal edge here, you flip a coin to say, is that a match or a mismatch? Throws away a lot of the correlations that exist if you just have a random sequence here and here, where matches occur have a complex correlation, and that can affect the result. If you make some simplifying assumptions, you can begin to get some rigorous results for these global alignment scores. But there's still really very little known about them. However, turns out that the global alignment problem is not the one that is of the most interest. And the reason is that when people started comparing proteins, they discovered, although there are certainly large families where the proteins in different species are related completely from one end to the other, one quickly discovers that proteins have a modular structure, and you can have a protein that has a little section in one end of it that's related to another region of a different protein, but the rest of the proteins aren't related. So you can have just locally related regions. And so people quickly wanted to not do these global sequence comparisons, but look, first of all, define what they meant by a local comparison, and then look for these local similarities. So there were a few sort of failed efforts at defining this in a useful way. And the first good definition, which is basically the one that, with a few minor modifications, is used today, was put forward in 1981 by Smith and Waterman. And they basically took this global alignment algorithm and said, we're going to do exactly what we did before, but rather than looking for the best score from here to here, we're going to allow an alignment to start anywhere in here and end anywhere. Of course, it has to end down this way from where it started, but you could start here and end here. And now that may seem like a much bigger problem because it's a global problem, but you can start and end anywhere, and how are you going to optimize that? It turns out to be simple. All you do is at each point here, you allow yourself, if the best score into that is negative, you just say, I'm going to start here with a score zero. And so you can always start in any place with a score zero, and you just keep track of what the best score you saw anywhere was. And so rather than just looking at what the score down here is, you say, where is the best score that ever occurred? And the best score that ever occurred was here. It means the optimal alignment ends at that place. You then trace back to the point where it began, which might be up here with the score of zero, and that is the best local alignment. So when people talk about the Smith-Waterman algorithm, it's exactly the same algorithm as Needleman-Wunsch. All that you do is you say that we can start anywhere and end anywhere, and the algorithm is a minor modification. You just can have a zero at any point. And if you think this through, you'll see how that works. Basically, all of the programs that people use to search databases that are popular for similarities in DNA and proteins are variations on the Smith-Waterman algorithm. The reason that there are variations on it is mainly that this n squared is too slow to do the whole search. It's not too slow if you have a supercomputer, if you have a massively parallel computer. You can still do a search of a current database with a very good program and a very good computer in an hour, perhaps, doing a full Smith-Waterman on every sequence in the database. So not in the DNA database, but in the protein database. If I was willing to devote an hour to it, I could search the whole thing. But that's more time than people want to spend. If you're working for years on one protein, it's not going to be too much time to spend an hour doing a database search. But if you're trying to analyze a lot of different things or test out different ideas and do different searches and explore things, it's really too long. And so people wanted faster programs. And so a number of heuristic algorithms got introduced. One was FastA, which I described before or mentioned before, and another was BLAST, which was developed at NCBI. Yes?
I have a question about the development.
Yeah. Right. Okay. That's an important question. Basically, if the protein's available, or if you know that the thing codes for protein and you know where it codes for protein, it is in general better to compare things at the protein level. This may seem counterintuitive because all of the information is there at the DNA level. So why are you comparing proteins if you have the DNA that codes for them? Well, the reason I say that it's better to compare it at the protein level is when people say compare it at the DNA level, what they usually mean is just have a score for matches and mismatches of the DNA sequences, which is sort of comparing it at the DNA level in a naive way. It's much more important to know what is being coded for. And so you could compare it at the DNA level where you're translating the DNA to protein and looking at what's getting coded for. But in essence, that's you can maybe get a little extra information by looking at the DNA, but what you end up really doing is just comparing the proteins. And so so the shorthand is to say that one should just compare proteins. And people have tried to develop what are basically codon-based DNA comparisons, and they maybe can give you a little extra information, but they're probably more effort than they're worth, and so it's generally just better to look at the protein level. You can do an information analysis on this, and what I'm going to talk about today, at the end of the talk today, I think you can get a sense of how you do this information analysis that shows that if the sequences are very closely related, you get more information looking at the DNA level. But once they've diverged by a relatively small amount, similarities that are easy to see at the protein level totally disappear at the DNA level. But that's because you've sort of when I say they disappear, it means that you're not allowed to look at the genetic code and obviously you can translate it to the protein and then they reemerge. But you basically, it's better to compare proteins if the sequences are coding for proteins. There are regions of DNA that don't code for proteins where you still want to compare the DNA and then you compare it at the DNA level. Well, the protein is more compressed in a certain sense than the DNA because it's more that it's you can see what the meaning is a little more easily looking at the in that sense, it's like a compressed file. If you look at the DNA and you look at just the zeros and ones, it doesn't tell you much. But if you translate the proteins, the things then begin to make more sense. So it's I could give a whole presentation on that, but basically it's better to compare it at the protein level than if that's available. Okay, now, so let's get on now. Now it's already 3:30, and I really haven't even begun the talk here. So this is where the next slide is where I usually begin, but I wanted to give you some background of why one's doing this. So let's take a 15-minute coffee break, and then we'll start up again. Okay. Someone asked me, and if you want to play with BLAST, you can run your searches on the over the internet. This is the website of where I work. It's ncbi.nlm, National Library of Medicine.nih.gov. You go there, somewhere on the page you'll find pretty prominently BLAST. You go to BLAST, and there are a lot of other things on this website, but you can go to BLAST and you can paste in a DNA sequence or a protein sequence and do a search. And I know that you'll learn anything by doing that, but if you want to do that, you can familiarize yourself with this, and it's all public. People, we run about 80,000 BLAST searches a day on our machines. We have a lot of machines doing this, but one reason we use BLAST rather than Smith-Waterman is we would need 100 times more machines if we were running Smith-Waterman. That's why you want to have these heuristic algorithms, although it only changes the constant. A constant makes a big difference sometimes.